Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, September 24th, 2020. Police in Jonglei State arrest suspects in connection to a killing.
Due to these scenarios, we run up people so that we get the suspect. Because people began to blame us. Police is not doing it. Police is not doing it well.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Police in Jonglei State capital Bor have detained at least seven people in connection with the killing of a woman in Bor's Al-Salam neighborhood last week. The Jonglei State Police Commissioner says the suspects tried to steal a water drum from the woman, and when she resisted, they shot her. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Bor.
Major General Joseph Mayana Akon, the Jonglei State Police Commissioner, says the suspects tried to steal a water drum from the woman identified as Lucia Nyaman. Akon says when she resisted, they shot and killed her. Daniel Obunan, Lucia Nyaman's husband, says he was asleep when the group of armed men arrived at his house and his wife first noticed unusual movement.
These people had searched the item in the compound and took a water container. My wife then went out and he immediately started wrestling with one of these guys while I was coming by with a stick. The guy hiding in the corner fired one bullet to the head. I did not stop and I heard the guys wrestling with my wife and I heard another gunshot. My wife was shot dead and I was also shot at my right hand.
Obunan says he wants justice for the murder of his wife. The police commissioner says the same men are suspected of shooting another man at Bors, a Naivasha neighborhood, the same week. He says the two incidents prompted the police to launch a crackdown on armed gangs terrorizing people in and around Bor town.
Due to these scenarios, we run up people so that we get the suspect. Because people began to blame us. Police is not doing it well. Police is not doing its work. We ran up people, and then people were screened. Some of them were released immediately that day. Then we remain with soldiers in the custody.
General Akon says police are carrying out investigations and will soon charge the suspects. A police officer, civil defense officer, and five South Sudan People's Defense Force soldiers with murder and causing terror in Bor town. Major General Lul Rai Kong, a spokesman of the South Sudan People's Defense Force, says any member of the military suspected of committing a capital offense should be arraigned in a military court.
When a member of our own ranks and files is involved in commission of criminals of crime, it normally is tried by a military court. Like the fresh case that I have on my mind, are the recent trials in Yei, where around 15 to 25 soldiers were sentenced to various terms in prison for crimes, so different crimes including rape and looting of civilian properties. They were tried before a military court martial. Then now that they have been sentenced, they will be transported to go and serve their jail sentences in civilian detention facilities. I think the same thing should apply in Bor.
Section 63 of the Sudan People's Liberation Army Act 2009 stipulates that any SPLA personnel who commits the offense of desertion shall, on conviction, be sentenced to imprisonment for a term not exceeding 7 years. Akon blames some SSPDF soldiers who have deserted their military barracks and are living with the community for most of the gang violence and burglaries happening in Bor town.
That is what they call tranquility. Even if I use high sound of my radio in a neighboring house, that one is it's a crime. Okay? I'm disturbing the tranquility of my neighbor. So these people who disturb people at night, we don't want them. We don't want them. And if we get them, who deal with them. We suspect our soldiers, those who deserted from different divisions of our SSPDF. Okay, they came and intermingling here in our communities.
For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Bor.
A report by the International Displacement Monitoring Center finds 14.6 million people have been newly displaced in the first half of this year. About one-third of these displacements were triggered by conflict and violence, primarily in Africa and Middle East. For VOA News, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Around 14.6 million people in 127 countries have been newly displaced between January and July because of natural and man-made disasters. This is about 1 million more than in the first half of last year. The Internal Displacement Monitoring Center report finds conflict and violence have sparked around one-third or 4.8 million new displacements, mainly in Africa and the Middle East. IDMC Director Alexandra Bilak says Syria tops the rank of countries with the highest increase in newly displaced. She says the military offensive in the country's northwest province of Idlib has prompted more than 1.4 million civilians to flee their homes.
DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, that also has seen a sharp increase in violence and armed violence and insecurity, particularly in its northeastern province of Ituri, which has also led to, as Syria, 1.4 million new displacements.
Bilak says Burkina Faso, with nearly a half million newly displaced, has become the worst displacement crisis in West Africa as armed conflict has expanded across the region. She expresses alarm at the rapidly deteriorating situations in Cameroon, Mozambique, Niger, and Somalia. She says growing conflict and violence in these countries have resulted in more new displacements in the first half of this year than in all of 2019. But she notes the situation of Yemen, currently considered the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe, remains of particular concern.
Although the numbers for Yemen are low, the reported numbers are low, we are highlighting the triple crisis that Yemen faces right now in the form of course, this ongoing and persistent conflict that has been exacerbated by high infection rates of COVID-19, as well as more recently some of the worst floods that the country has experienced in years.
Indeed, the report finds slow and sudden onset of natural disasters around the world have triggered 9.8 million new displacements. It reports cyclones in India and Bangladesh, floods and swarms of locusts in East Africa, devastating wildfires in Australia and the United States have resulted in the forced evacuations of millions of people in fear of their lives. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Kenyan lawmakers want the operating cost of a China-built railway cut in half and have called for renegotiating the Chinese loan taken to finance the line's construction. Kenya's National Assembly Transport Committee says huge operation losses and debt to Chinese banks are straining taxpayers already hit by the economic fallout from the COVID-19. Muhammad Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Members of the National Assembly's Transport Committee unveiled a report Wednesday asking the House to push for reduced cost on the Chinese-built railway line known as the Standard Gauge Railway, or SGR. The head of the committee, David Kosing, says lawmakers also want the government to seek new terms for the $4.5 billion in loans used to build the railway.
We also recommended that the entire loan framework should also be negotiated, the original loan framework. Now with COVID-19, and of course Kenya and the world will never be the same again with these effects of COVID-19, that loan should be renegotiated downwards or agree on even extending the time upon which we should have paid the loan.
The railway carries goods from the port of Mombasa to Nairobi. In 2019, it transported 9 million tons of goods. Kenya currently pays $1 million every month to China's Africa Star Railway Operation Company to run the railway. Since 2017, Kenya failed to meet the monthly payment for 21 months. Parliament wants the monthly cost to be brought to $600,000 and wants to engage China on how to pay the loan. Tony Watima is an economist based in Kenya. He says China may be reluctant to negotiate a deal with Kenya.
Well, the latest update we've seen that China has renegotiated debt with Angola. But the circumstances are different. Angola's debt is commodity-backed. So they export commodities, especially oil. So for Kenya, those are debts that were not commodity-backed. We're just given debts for investment projects. So the risks are high on the China side, and they will look at Kenya as a country not like Angola. And so renegotiating those terms will be a big problem because they will have, that means China has to take a lot of risks in negotiating the debt restructuring. That's one of the things that we've not seen China engage any African country on that.
Between 2010 and 2018, China lent over $150 billion to African nations for projects mainly related to its Belt and Road initiatives. In June, Kenya's Court of Appeal ruled that Kenya Railways Corporation, as a procuring entity of the Standard Gauge Railway, failed to meet the constitutional threshold of fairness and transparency. Okia Omtata is an activist who has pushed the government to make the details of its deal with China public since 2013.
I think the context of what the parliament should be saying is that we are not going to pay China for an illegal contract, and at the end of the day, you have crooks in China, you have crooks in Kenya who are in power, and they negotiated this thing, and the people of Kenya cannot be burdened by what they are not benefiting from.
The railway carried more than 19,000 passengers and 421,000 tons of cargo between Nairobi and Mombasa in July, following a hiatus caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, how is Uganda without President Museveni? That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
if you could swap lives for a day, who would you swap with and why?
I'll swap with our finance minister because I think he's doing a human job and I want to have a feel of what he goes through in a day.
I'll change with my dad because I love him so much. He has been there for us. I mean, like, he has taken us in good schools. He has taken care of us because for us, our mom is not working. We depend on our dad.
If I was to swap with someone, I feel I admire myself more than anyone in this life, and I feel I'm capable of doing what those people are doing, so I would not swap for any person.
I would like to change position with the president because I feel it would be nice to give instruction to everyone.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA health correspondent Linar Mudu. The World Health Organization and the Africa Centers for Disease Control say there are no drugs approved to fight COVID-19. If you have tested positive, talk to a doctor before taking any medicines. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. In Uganda, the author of a new book says the country's young men and women should move away from indifference to actively fight against oppression. Nelson Kweni is the author of a book entitled Uganda Without Museveni, / Museveni's Quest for Power, Who Pays the Price? The book was launched this week by four-time presidential candidate Dr. Kizza Besigye. Kweni refers to Besigye as an icon. He says it has been 6 years since he graduated from the university and without a job. Kweni says he wrote the book for the many Ugandans who, although graduated from the university and cannot find a job.
I was born in 1989 and I found Mr. Museveni a president. And as I've gone up to university, my parents selling all the property we have at home and sending me to school. After graduating with a university degree, it has taken me now 6 years with no job. So I write this story. It is not a story about Nelson Nkwene alone. It's a story about many Ugandans who have gone to school and they cannot get jobs, who cannot get medical care, who dehumanized and bullied and beaten on streets whenever they try to express their opinion to do with the dictatorship of Mr. Museveni is concerned. And so I wrote this book that gives fellow Ugandans, fellow discontented Ugandans, an understanding of who Mr. Museveni is.
Now, four-time presidential candidate Dr. Kizza Besigye launched your book this week. What does this mean to you as a young author?
Dr. Kizza Besigye is an icon and the founder and the father of the struggle against the dictatorship of Mr. Museveni. So he means a lot. He's symbolic. His presence on the launch of my book, it sends a big signal to fellow discontented Ugandans that it is the book that if really Ugandans want to liberate themselves, indeed they need to give attention, and it is a tool that they need if we are to liberate our country from the fangs of Museveni dictatorship.
Ugandans will vote in presidential election next year. How do you think your book fit into the whole scheme of Ugandan politics?
My brother James, the Ugandan politics as we talk of now, the president we have, Mr. Museveni, he clearly puts to us that for him is like a kotapini. If I may explain to you what a kotapini is, it's the part of the body of a bicycle. It can only be put by a hammer and can only be removed by a hammer. So I do not have lots of expectations in the next year elections. Mr. Museveni cannot be removed by elections. Ugandans need a collective action model to act as citizens and do away with Museveni.
Dr. Besigye said in launching your book that Ugandans need to move away from indifference to active discontent and actively fight oppression. Do you share these views?
Actually, my book is a call to fellow Ugandans to move away from indifference towards active discontent in the struggle against dictatorship of Mr. Museveni.
Any particular message for young would-be Ugandan authors or for the young people of Uganda in general?
My message goes to fellow Ugandans, more especially the youth, that fellow Ugandans, we need not be manipulated anymore by Mr. Museveni and his cronies and NRM. We need the change that is going to give us our political rights, where everyone is going to grow to full potential, irrespective of where we are born, irrespective of our ethnic background, irrespective of our religion.
That's Nelson Kweni, author of the new book entitled Uganda Without Museveni, Museveni's Quest for Power, Who Pays the Price. He was speaking with us from Kampala. Rights groups in Kenya are suing the government over human rights violation and deaths allegedly caused by police enforcing a coronavirus curfew. The rights group, on behalf of victims, are seeking compensations from the state for police brutality. Rahel Ombur reports from Nairobi.
The rights groups Amnesty International Kenya, International Justice Mission Kenya, Haki Africa and Kituo cha Sheria says police use the nighttime curfew to violate the rights of victims at a critical time. Annette Mbogo is Executive Director of Kituo cha Sheria, also known as the Legal Advice Center. She explained the decision to sue the government.
Within the pandemic, that's when the government responsibility towards its people should be even higher than when things are just as normal. During this time, there was a much higher responsibility of the police to ensure that they protect as opposed to meeting violence against the citizenry. So we feel that the issues being brought in this case are unique in that respect.
The petition included demands for long-term legislative reform aimed at addressing cases of alleged police brutality in the country.
This is not the first time that these incidences have been happening. What is different in this particular case is that, one, we are not just seeking an administrative decision, but we are seeking a court decision, a declaratory decision from the court that spells out the importance of the police not using excessive force as they execute their mandate. Number two also is that we are asking the court to ensure that there is one particular department or a cabinet secretary who will be assigned with implementing the legislation that relates to protection of the citizenry from excessive force.
The petitioners include five family members of people who were allegedly killed by police during curfew enforcement. One of them is Hussein Moyo Molte, whose son, 13-year-old Yasin Moyo, was shot on the balcony of his house in Nairobi's Kiamaiko neighborhood in March. Duncan Diema, the police officer who allegedly killed Yasin, pleaded not guilty to murder charges and was later released on cash bail pending trial. Yasin's father says he hopes he will get justice through the trial or possibly through the lawsuit. He said, "What we are looking for is justice. I have not seen an officer come to me and tell me that they are on my side. I am working with those holding my hand. The case may or may not succeed, but the most important thing is that we are standing and demanding for justice." In June, the Independent Policing Oversight Authority, IPOA, a government institution that watches the work of the police in Kenya, said there had been 15 deaths linked to police action during curfew enforcement since March. Nairobi human rights activist Rama Wako says the number could be higher. She says, "We have filed so many cases such as this in the past. Yasin's moved fast because of the media attention and involvement from rights bodies. Because of that, there is a chance that there might be justice. But we have so many cases where we do not always have the media and others on board. In such, justice is always a challenge." In recent months, Kenya's government has relaxed most of the country's coronavirus restrictions and shortened curfew hours. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Ghanaian artist has been documenting the journey of second-hand clothing imported in Ghana and the impact of the corona pandemic on those who rely on this trade. Authorities say they are reinforcing a ban on imported second-hand undergarments due to fears they could further stress public health. But those on the ground say the ban further impacts livelihood already strained due to the pandemic. For VOA News, Stacey Knotts reports from Accra.
Multimedia artist Sal Kofiga documents the many hands that imported second-hand clothing and fabrics pass through in the bustling Cantamanto market in Accra, which largely deals with goods discarded by the West.
In this process of distribution, you get people who are carrying these goods on their shoulders and then on their heads to warehouses, to shops and all these things. And then we have people who pull the bills on trucks and then distribute them to other places. So before the shirts even or the dress even gets to the unknown person who is coming to buy it, there is a lot of work that goes into it. And that is where I am more like interested in trying to see how these things affect people.
Kofiga's work focuses on the complex challenges within the market, including people's livelihoods and the excess production the market represents. prior to the pandemic, American NGO The Ore Foundation estimated about 15 million items arrived weekly and that about 40% ended up discarded. That means, aside from the livelihoods this trade supports, Ghana is burdened with discarding what the West doesn't want. The coronavirus, which causes the COVID-19 disease, has had a major impact here. Fewer imports are coming in and buyer demand has decreased. Those who live on daily wages are especially vulnerable. They have been reliant on NGOs and charitable support to survive, market worker Abdullahi Rukaya says.
Because of the COVID, the business come down. Even I have a child. Even the whole of the day, if I don't get something, how can my child feed?
While those in the market wait for work to pick up again, there are concerns over a clampdown on some items after authorities said they were reinforcing an existing ban over fears some imports could spread diseases. Legislation banning second-hand undergarments, mattresses and sanitary wear took effect in 1994 due to health fears and concerns Ghana was being used as a dumping ground. But some of these items can still be found in the markets. A Ghana Standards Authority officer said porous borders are partly to blame, but added the current clampdown has led to a huge reduction in these items. NGO People's Dialogue on Human Settlements says there are negative implications for bans like this for those who rely on selling these goods and those who buy them due to their cheaper price. Abdul Muhib Salifu, a program manager at the NGO, says focusing on upgrading the market would be more useful and believes people have always been careful to wash anything bought from the market.
The informal economy, we like it or not, plays a very big role in government's management of economic situations. So sometimes when politicians try to raise, they just see one law somewhere and then they ask them and they say, that law, it bans these people from this. We are going to enforce it. You can't enforce laws when you don't create alternatives.
For his part, artist Kofiga also turns fabrics from the market into upcycled clothes, which he hopes will inspire a greener global fashion industry. Kofiga says he doesn't want second-hand garment imports into Ghana to cease, but that he just wants to highlight the excessive waste fast fashion creates and to inspire people to have a better appreciation for what still has some use. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song My Country by Lonely Boy.
Na na na, we back again. Lonely boy, the master we back again. And I'm busy kidding.
Junub Sudan,
I am a team.
Junub Sudan,
my country.
Junub Sudan,
Ghana school.
Junub Sudan,
and I'm busy kidding.
Junub Sudan,
I am a team.
Junub Sudan,
my country.
Junub Sudan,
Ghana school.
Junub Sudan,
and I'm a replay. Nasketir ma biru du beleto. Mon bi haliso. Come on, this city move. Malu, you know Sudan. De beleta masakila po. Gebelia fogo. Come on, dia fogo. Mi, malis papa. Ita kandrua bi beleta zon. Kene itariza. Asanta abinu. Risala de. Kede wasulu le kulu junubin. Kede mon hare. Bele u bele takim. I'm lonely boy, BMC music, oh na na, no no no, and I'm busy kidding,
Junub Sudan,
I am a team,
Junub Sudan.
We've been listening to Lonely Boy from BDBD Refugee Camp with the song My Country. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask if you must leave your home. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Aina na,
lady
se ba makwa, aina na,
lady
se ba kakwa, aina na.
nana.
Il disait pas coucou,
aïe nana.
Il l'a qu'il n'a pas pour eux.
Anabise kiri,
Junub Sudan.
Aïe ma im,
Junub Sudan.
My country,
Junub Sudan.
Dana school.